Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show,
this feels like a little glimmering light at the end of the tunnel. Any kind of framework to standardise these energy, cooling, heating standards for landlords to adhere to would be incredible.
South Australia is debating a bill which will allow tenants to set up basic housing standards. We have all the details. Also, international first, regulations will be imposed on e-bike operators in New South Wales to incentive more responsible use of shared e-bikes. And later today,
frogs are really important for healthy ecosystems. They should be in abundance in healthy ecosystems, and when they're in absent, it could signal that something is amiss.
Australians are in the search for frogs all across the country. What's the project about? We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today. Today the Liberal Party is in Canberra to debate whether to keep or scrap net zero emissions by 2025, a decision which will shape the future of the party. After a devastating election loss, the coalition is looking to rebuild their voter base. Now millennials and Gen Z now make up 47% of the electorate. With a generation of young voters facing the reality of climate change, the coalition faces a similar existential crisis. The Wire's Amelia Crouch spoke with professor from the University of Western Sydney's Institute for Culture and Society, Philippa Collin, about the fate of net zero determining the future for the coalition's border base.
What we saw in the previous election really demonstrated how what the Liberal Party was offering to younger voters hasn't met the mark. So we know younger voters are being extremely concerned about cost of living, about the future of work, and about property prices, all of which are related to one of the big concerns for that generation, which is around climate change. I think for the Liberal Party to regain voting support from the general public as well as the younger voters, both who both voted in the last election and who will be voting in the next election, they have to come up with some really significant and serious policies relating to those issues.
Net zero, to have net zero emissions by 2050, that was previously a bipartisan policy, which was actually made, like, enforced by the coalition once they signed the Paris Agreement. Why do you think now net zero has become a partisan issue?
Yeah, look, it's quite bewildering, really, in many regards. I think the Australian public is very much in support of greater action on climate change. Even some of the data that's been released today, which suggests about one third of the Australian public are less sure than they were about net zero, really doesn't speak for the other third to two thirds of the Australian public that want to see decisive action on climate change. And among younger people, it's much higher than that. So that 77% of young people want to see decisive action on climate change. I think obviously there's a bit of a shift in the broader global space around commitment to net zero and agreement around what kind of action on climate change is necessary. And, you know, I mean, the Liberal Party perhaps hanging on to some older ideas about how we might be able to achieve real change on climate.
Would, like, dumping net zero imply on some level that the coalition denies the threat of climate change?
Well, they are saying that they don't deny the threat of climate change, but I think what it's saying is they're not taking it seriously enough. We know from the latest IPCC report, from all of the scientific experts, both in Australia and internationally, that, you know, we need to take this seriously, and not just that we need to take action to kind of prevent the acceleration of climate-related impacts. We're already facing the realities of increased heat and extreme heat and other climate-related disasters. So it is a bit hard to understand what their alternative strategy is. They haven't been clear about that. And what is for sure is that the status quo is not going to be good enough either from the perspective of the climate or the Australian public.
How could they potentially still address climate change and win back those young voters and those inner city teal seats without necessarily having a robust net zero climate policy?
It's hard from my perspective to see that happening. Certainly the last election, I think, was a very clear message to particularly the Liberals that climate change and the associated effects that climate change has on things like cost of living, housing, you know, that all of these areas are impacted, whether that's through food security, whether that's through increased insurance premiums or availability of houses, particularly in communities that have been disaster affected, and so forth, we cannot drop the ball on this. And for young people, it's even more important. Young people, I mean, even just this week, have released the Child and Youth Statement on Climate, which will be delivered at the Conference of Parties in Brazil, in which more than 800 young people around Australia contributed to a position statement where they very clearly ask for stronger action to reduce Australia's emissions in line with the global 1.5 degree target, which we've of course surpassed and need to get back down under, greater investment in climate resilience services, and youth-centred energy transition planning. And we don't see any of those things really reflected in what the Liberal Party is saying at the moment.
Today they're discussing net zero. They'll probably be discussing it tomorrow as well and finally coming to a decision. It's looking like they are going to at least dump a robust net zero by 2050 climate policy. How would this decision impact the potential of the coalition forming government in the future?
Well, it looks unlikely that the coalition will get numbers on its own and without support of other independents and without, as I said, kind of winning back many of the seats that they lost at the election. It's quite difficult to see how they would be able to form government again.
Professor Philippa Colling from the University of Western Sydney there, speaking with The Wire's Amelia Crouch.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Today, the South Australian government is debating the Residential Tenancies Bill, which will force rentals to set out basic standards for heating, cooling, and energy efficiency. It will also force households to be fixed properly so tenants have healthy spaces. For more than 8 years, hospitality worker Alessia has been renting a property west of Adelaide, but the household has so many unfixed problems, she has decided to solve them herself as much as possible. I started asking Alessia to describe the issues she's having with her rental.
So I have been lucky enough to be living in my rental west of the city for the last 5 years. And I have a little bit of a laundry list of things that I've put together to sort of explain what I'm facing. I'm draft-proofing my own windows. It's an old house, but you can feel the draft even when everything is closed up. So there's foam that I've bought myself, all on the windows. Tinting, it's the way the house is facing. The sunshine that comes through is beautiful, but in the summer, it cooks whatever room it's coming into. So I had to buy tinting for my windows, and I also have packing insulation, the reflective bubble wrap stuff for my windows. None of these windows have screens, so while it is drafty in the house, when I do want anything open, I can't. There's no fly screen, there's no safety security screens there. I've recently done some mold test kits, which are surprisingly easy to get your hands on. Swab tests and just sitting in the air, so there's no window in the internal bathroom. So definitely a few issues. And yeah, I'm also putting hessian over the veranda out the back as well.
So I'm guessing all of these issues as well have been, you know, when you started renting the property, everything was okay, and you know, it's just because of natural use, I'm guessing.
Well, not quite. So I've sort of taken it into my own hands, summer-proofing or, you know, tent-proofing the house, especially for this summer. The previous summers have all been bad, which has kind of given me the ideas to take agency in it and change something. In times past, housemates have blocked windows, had freestanding aircon units. There's only two wall units in the house and one is in the shared space as well. So this has definitely been an issue the last 5 years.
And what did the property agency tell you when you address these issues happening in your rental?
So notoriously, regardless of there being housemates, I've been the one to contact my real estate agent. And I can't help but feel that any issues that I bring up straight to him do get swept under the rug. And if I do lodge maintenance requests through their official line, through email, it's the same maintenance guy that shows up, tells me they're going to bulldoze the place anyway and do the worst band-aid job you've ever seen. So, and I can't lie, the lease is ending soon and I don't have the means to potentially move. So I actually haven't said anything. Unfortunately, I have been a very quote-unquote low-maintenance tenant, despite how I might sound. And I don't want to be pushed out of this space. I work in the area. I've lived in the area for so long. I'm hoping it's something we can tackle.
No, South Australia can get very hot, you know, during the summer. It's a very dry heat, and it could reach up to 45 degrees. What challenges have you faced, you know, especially when you're trying to get flatmates to share the house?
So we suffer a lot. The wall units we have are those old 70s ones, so not even the long rectangular ones, just the really small ones that kind of push out air and don't really do much. The house is equipped with ducted air conditioning that has not been maintained or repaired. But yeah, no, with no windows, no feasible way to have a cooling unit in each room, because you know, every time summer rolls around, they're actually kind of hard to get your hands on. I've seen Bunnings just cleaned out of all cooling stuff. And, you know, I've lived with people before who don't have a car, they work casual jobs, so they genuinely suffer through it and it's awful.
So there's a bill today that will be discussed in South Australia about minimum standards in South Australian houses. What would you like to happen today?
Yeah, so this feels like a little glimmering light at the end of the tunnel, or just the beginning, but any kind of framework to standardise these energy, cooling, heating standards for landlords to adhere to would be incredible. You know, in my own case, that might mean, you know, fixing the ducted air conditioning, having that working so the bedrooms have access to some kind of cooling. Yeah, just building that framework. It applies to renters and private renters, but also, you know, housing trust renters and people in more crisis situations or financial unstable situations as well. So, yeah, it's a bit of a glimmering light.
That was hospitality worker and tenant Alessia. The bill is supported by several organizations, including SACOS and the Anti-Poverty Network SA. Listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on ACCC, to our listeners in Taree on Tubob Radio, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. Clutter of e-bikes is hindering access to pathways and entrances, leading the New South Wales government to regulate the shared e-bike space, teaming up with councils to determine safe locations of use. The Wire's Stephen Hill explores whether there's a solution to ensure the increased number of e-bikes in urban locations are responsibly used.
In New South Wales, we've seen the use of e-bikes take off, with figures from Transport New South Wales showing that 15% of the population have used an e-bike for transportation. This has provided a green alternative to travel across the city, but the large increase of e-bikes strewn across the city has also become a barrier of movement for others when these bikes block passageways and entrances. To deal with this issue, the state government announced new regulations that aim to ensure these bikes are used properly. The CEO of Bicycles New South Wales, Peter McLean, is supportive of this move.
This is actually national leading regulation, so the first time it's ever been done in Australia. Hats off to the New South Wales government for leading the way in this. Bicycle New South Wales is very, very supportive of the legislation that's currently going through the New South Wales Parliament and the regulatory bills which will come through after that. It's really, really positive to see. We have seen this space completely unregulated for years, and there's a lot of risks and challenges associated with that. So the new regulations, which will be passed soon, will ensure that we have all of the upsides, the convenience, the cost effectiveness, the ease of transport with e-mobility and the shared e-bikes right across the city, and make those more consistent, but also ensuring that they're not getting in the way of pedestrians and they're not causing clutter and litter in the city.
Shadow Transport Minister Natalie Ward is similarly supportive of this regulation to ensure shared bikes are placed in safe locations.
Overall, we support the government's legislation on the shared schemes. We think it's a good thing to start there by cleaning that up. And we do want to ensure that those schemes are successful, and we want to make sure that we're part of that solution to cleaning up those bikes strewn around the footpaths.
The regulation for shared e-bikes will see the New South Wales government team up with councils to determine locations that are no-go zones and go-slow zones, and determine where these bikes can be safely stored. And bike providers that refuse to comply will be liable for fines of up to $55,000 and $5,500 per day for each bike that remains in a prohibited location. CEO of Bicycles New South Wales, Peter McLean, believes these sanctions will incentivise more responsible use of shared e-bikes.
They also include implications and consequences. There is a carrot and a stick approach. The companies can actually be fined under the new regulations. That carrot and stick approach already applied for helmet use, for example. If the helmet isn't returned with the bicycle, some providers actually provide a disincentive and a cost allocated to your fee structure for not returning the helmet. That could also be implemented for parking the bike in inappropriate or unallocated locations. There might be a $5 surcharge, for example, which would provide a disincentive for people putting it in the wrong spot.
Shadow Transport Minister Natalie Ward is similarly supportive of this regulation to ensure shared bikes are placed in safe locations, but suggests that the regulations do not go far enough when it comes to dealing with other aspects of user behaviour.
I think it's good and we support it. We want to make sure that those congested areas where there is a lot of pedestrian activity together with bikes and the shared bikes is cleaned up and that the councils are empowered to do that. At the moment, we have heard from councils and police and indeed community groups that they don't have the power to do anything about it. But as I say, we also want the right of behaviour as the next step to be dealt with. I think it's really important that the behaviour of our young people is dealt with and addressed by this government. It's not something that is going to go away. In fact, we've seen a huge increase in the uptake of e-bikes. We're coming into the Christmas and summer periods, which is a great time, a joyful time in beautiful Sydney and New South Wales to be out and about. But we would like to see more from the government about that dangerous behaviour. 2-3 kids on the back of a bike, going down to the beach, no helmets and often no shoes. I sound like a mum, but you know, ensuring that they are safe riding them, but they're also keeping other people safe and they're aware that they are at speed and coming into contact with someone, a pedestrian, for example, especially the elderly. You know, an injury to an elderly person can be very severe. But also we know with toddlers, they may not stay within the walk lanes. Other riders on the bikes, it can be a very dangerous thing to be out there and in the hands of a young person who's inexperienced and might not know how to veer or avoid or ride defensively. That could be a huge problem. We don't want to see more injuries, and we certainly don't want to see more deaths.
New South Wales Shadow Minister for Transport, Natalie Ward there, ending the report by The Wire's Stephen Hill.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
This week, the search for frogs in backyards and parks continues with the biggest Citizen Science project in full swing. Frog ID kicked off last Friday and is asking Australians to look out for frogs and log their image in an app, where scientists can determine more new frog species. Last year, 4 species were new to science, and this year is expected to discover more frogs across the nation. I started asking Frog ID's project coordinator, Nadia Rosland, DM of the project.
The Australian Museum's National Frog ID Week kicks off 7th of November, and it's the world's largest frog count. So this year is our 8th annual Frog ID Week event, and it's providing an annual snapshot of how frogs are doing across the country. And we're doing this by focusing on frog calls, because every species of frog makes a unique call. So people across Australia, anyone with a smartphone, can get involved by downloading the free Frog ID app on their smartphones and recording any of the frogs they hear, submit it to our scientists at the Australian Museum, and then it goes into this large database that's helping understand and conserve our frogs.
Now, how many frogs has the project identified over these last 8 years, thanks to the support of Australians interested in frogs?
Absolutely. So thanks to the efforts of tens of thousands of people using the free Frog ID app, we have gathered nearly 1.4 million scientific records of frogs across Australia, and that's across about 230 different species, which is equivalent to about 88% of the known species of frog in Australia. Now, I say known because this number is always increasing. There's still species out there that we don't know yet exist, and through these recordings that people are submitting, we've actually helped inform the scientific description of 13 different frog species in Australia.
So Nadia, why are frogs so important for the environment, and what's their role within the ecosystem?
Frogs are really important for healthy ecosystems. They should be in abundance in healthy ecosystems, and when they're in absent, it could signal that something is amiss. And this is because frogs are very sensitive to changes around them. They have this permeable skin, which they absorb everything around them. They drink and breathe through their skin, so they're susceptible from pollution and all these chemicals around us. So they really indicate when something's not right. And we want them around because their tadpoles help keep our streams clean, but also frogs are eaten by a lot of native frogs, and they are important connections between freshwater and terrestrial ecosystems. So when we know from overseas studies that when frogs are disappeared from ecosystems, we actually experience horrible ecosystem collapse, and no other animal fulfills the role, the important roles that frogs and tadpoles have in the environment. So we want them around for a number of reasons, and also one of those is to eat these pest species that we don't want around, like mosquitoes that carry diseases and things like that.
So how can Australians help to identify frogs across the country, and what kind of frogs is the project focusing on this year?
Yeah, so we can simply use the Frog ID app on the smartphone to record a frog call, or whenever you think a frog is calling. There are many insect-sounding frogs out there, so you may capture an insect at first, but that's okay. And simply record for a minimum of 20 seconds up to a minute on the Frog ID app and submit it to our team. And right now we're focusing on a lot of different frog species, from our ground frogs, like burrowing frogs, like the knife-footed frog that only emerges after heavy rain. And it looks like there will be a bit of rain in more western parts of the state, in Queensland, New South Wales, and even northern Australia. So with rain, frogs are more active. So we're hoping that with this rainfall that more people will hear frogs around them and record them. But even the common frogs we have around our backyards and urban parks, like the common eastern froglet, that does sound very much like a cricket, or the striped marsh frog that sounds like a tennis ball being hit, or even the screaming tree frog if that's in your area, and that's quite a piercing sound. We want recordings of those common species as well as the rarer ones that we don't often hear.
And Nadia, where can people get more information about the project, and where can they be more involved about it?
You can learn more about the National Frog ID Project by the Australian Museum on our website. That's www.frogid.net.au, and that's where you'll also find more information on our annual Frog ID Week event and learn about our prizes that we have for the top frogger, and see the leaderboard and see if you can get on the leaderboard by recording frog calls around you. And you can also download the app from our website as well.
That was project coordinator from Frog ID, Nadia Roslan. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you're in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. If you would like to listen to any of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Jagera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. I'm Eduardo Jordan. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.